Chapter 66. Among the faded bridal relics with which it was strewn, I took advantage of the moment I had sought one from the first to leave the room, after beseeching Estella's attention to her, with a movement of my hand. When I left, Estella was yet standing by the great chimney piece, just as she had stood throughout. Miss Havisham's gray hair was all adrift upon the ground, among the other bridal wrecks, and was a miserable sight to see. It was with a depressed heart that I walked in the starlight for an hour and more, about the courtyard, and about the brewery, and about the ruined garden. When I at last took courage to return to the room, I found Estella sitting at Miss Havisham's knee, taking up some stitches in one of those old articles of dress that were dropping to pieces, and of which I have often been reminded, since by the faded tatters of old banners that I have seen hanging up in cathedrals. Afterwards, Estella and I played at cards, as of yore only we were skillful now, and played French games, and so the evening wore away, and I went to bed. I lay in that separate building across the courtyard. It was the first time I had ever lain down to rest in Satis House, and sleep refused to come near me. A thousand Miss Havishams haunted me. She was on this side of my pillow, on that, at the head of the bed, at the foot, behind the half-open door of the dressing room, in the room overhead, in the room beneath everywhere. At last, when the night was slow to creep on towards 2 o'clock, I felt that I absolutely could no longer bear the place as a place to lie down in, and that I must get up. I therefore got up and put on my clothes, and went out across the yard into the long stone passage, designing to gain the outer courtyard and walk there for the relief of my mind. But, I was no sooner in the passage than I extinguished my candle, for, I saw Miss Havisham going along it in a ghostly manner, making a low cry. I followed her at a distance, and saw her go up the staircase. She carried a bare candle in her hand, which she had probably taken from one of the sconces, in her own room, and was a most unearthly object by its light. Standing at the bottom of the staircase, I felt the mildewed air of the feast chamber, without seeing her open the door, and I heard her walking there, and so across into her own room, and so across again into that, never ceasing the low cry. After a time, I tried in the dark both to get out, and to go back, but I could do neither until some streaks of day strayed in, and showed me where to lay my hands. During the whole interval, whenever I went to the bottom of the staircase, I heard her footstep, saw her light pass above, and heard her ceaseless low cry. Before we left next day, there was no revival of the difference between her and Estella, nor was it ever revived on any similar occasion. And there were 4 similar occasions, to the best of my remembrance. Nor did Miss Havisham's manner towards Estella in any wise change, except that I believed it to have something like fear infused among its former characteristics. It is impossible to turn this leaf of my life, without putting Bentley Drummle's name upon it, or I would, very gladly. On a certain occasion, when the Finches were assembled in force, and when good feeling was being promoted in the usual manner by nobody's agreeing with anybody else, the presiding Finch called the Grove to order, forasmuch as Mr. Drummle had not yet toasted a lady, which, according to the solemn constitution of the society, it was the brute's turn to do that day. I thought I saw him leer in an ugly way at me, while the decanters were going round, but as there was no love lost between us, that might easily be. What was my indignant surprise, when he called upon the company, to pledge him to Estella. "Estella who?" said one. "Never you mind," retorted Drummle. "Estella of where?" said one. "You are bound to say of where," which he was, as a Finch. "Of Richmond, gentlemen," said Drummle, putting me out of the question, "and a peerless beauty." Much he knew about peerless beauties, a mean miserable idiot. I whispered Herbert. "I know that lady," said Herbert, across the table, when the toast had been honored. "Do you?" said Drummle. "And so do I," added, with a scarlet face. "Do you?" said Drummle. Oh, Lord! This was the only retort except glass or crockery that the heavy creature was capable of making, but I became as highly incensed by it as if it had been barbed with wit, and I immediately rose in my place and said that I could not but regard it as being like the Honorable Finch's impudence to come down to that grove we always talked about coming down to that grove, as a neat parliamentary turn of expression down to that grove, proposing a lady of whom he knew nothing. Mr. Dremel, upon this, starting up, demanded what I meant by that, whereupon I made him the extreme reply that I believed he knew where I was to be found. Whether it was possible in a Christian country to get on without blood, after this, was a question on which the Finches were divided. The debate upon it grew so lively, indeed, that at least six more honorable members told six more, during the discussion, that they believed they knew where they were to be found. However, it was decided at last, the grove being a court of honor, that if Mr. Dremel would bring never so slight a certificate from the lady, importing that he had the honor of her acquaintance, Mr. Pip must express his regret, as a gentleman and a Finch, for having been betrayed into a warmth which. Next day was appointed for the production, lest our honor should take cold from delay, and next day Dremel appeared with a polite little avowal in Estella's hand, that she had had the honor of dancing with him several times. This left me no course but to regret that I had been betrayed into a warmth which, and on the whole to repudiate, as untenable, the idea that I was to be found anywhere. Dremel and I then sat snorting at one another for an hour, while the grove engaged in indiscriminate contradiction, and finally the promotion of good feeling was declared to have gone ahead at an amazing rate. I tell this lightly, but it was no light thing to me. For, I cannot adequately express what pain it gave me to think that Estella should show any favor to a contemptible, clumsy, sulky booby, so very far below the average. To the present moment, I believe it to have been referable to some pure fire of generosity and disinterestedness in my love for her, that I could not endure the thought of her stooping to that hound. No doubt I should have been miserable whomsoever she had favored, but a worthier object would have caused me a different kind and degree of distress. It was easy for me to find out, and I did soon find out, that Dremel had begun to follow her closely, and that she allowed him to do it. A little while, and he was always in pursuit of her, and he and I crossed one another every day. He held on, in a dull persistent way, and Estella held him on, now with encouragement, now with discouragement, now almost flattering him, now openly despising him, now knowing him very well, now scarcely remembering who he was. The spider, as Mr. Jaggers had called him, was used to lying in wait, however, and had the patience of his tribe. Added to that, he had a blockhead confidence in his money and in his family greatness, which sometimes did him good service, almost taking the place of concentration and determined purpose. So, the spider, doggedly watching Estella, outwatched many brighter insects, and would often uncoil himself and drop at the right nick of time. At a certain assembly ball at Richmond, there used to be assembly balls at most places then, where Estella had outshone all other beauties, this blundering Dremel so hung about her, and with so much toleration on her part, that I resolved to speak to her concerning him. I took the next opportunity, which was when she was waiting for Mrs. Brandley to take her home, and was sitting apart among some flowers, ready to go. I was with her, for I almost always accompanied them to and from such places. Are you tired, Estella? Rather, Pip. You should be. Say rather, I should not be, for I have my letter to Satis House to write before I go to sleep. Recounting tonight's triumph? Said one. Surely a very poor one, Estella. What do you mean? I didn't know there had been any. Estella, said I, do look at that fellow in the corner yonder, who is looking over here at us. Why should I look at him? Returned Estella, with her eyes on me instead. What is there in that fellow in the corner yonder, to use your words, that I need look at? Indeed, that is the very question I want to ask you, said one. For he has been hovering about you all night. Moths, and all sorts of ugly creatures, replied Estella, with a glance towards him, hover about a lighted candle. Can the candle help it? No, I returned. But cannot the Estella help it? Well, said she, laughing, after a moment, perhaps. Yes, anything you like. But, Estella, do hear me speak. It makes me wretched that you should encourage a man so generally despised as Dremel. You know he is despised. Well, said she, you know he is as ungainly within as without. A deficient, ill-tempered, lowering, stupid fellow. Well, said she, you know he has nothing to recommend him but money and the ridiculous role of addle-headed predecessors. Now, don't you? Well, said she again, and each time she said it, she opened her lovely eyes the wider. To overcome the difficulty of getting past that monosyllable, I took it from her, and said, repeating it with emphasis, well, then, that is why it makes me wretched. Now, if I could have believed that she favored Dremel with any idea of making me wretched, I should have been in better heart about it. But in that habitual way of hers, she put me so entirely out of the question, that I could believe nothing of the kind. Pip, said Estella, casting her glance over the room, don't be foolish about its effect on you. It may have its effect on others, and may be meant to have. It's not worth discussing. Yes it is, said I, because I cannot bear that people should say she throws away her graces and attractions on a mere boor, the lowest in the crowd. I can bear it, said Estella. Oh, don't be so proud, Estella, and so inflexible. Calls me proud and inflexible in this breath, said Estella, opening her hands, and in his last breath reproached me for stooping to a boor. There is no doubt you do, said I, something hurriedly, for I have seen you give him looks and smiles this very night, such as you never give to me. Do you want me then, said Estella, turning suddenly with a fixed and serious, if not angry, look, to deceive and entrap you? Do you deceive and entrap him, Estella? Yes, and many others, all of them but you. Here is Mrs. Brandley. I'll say no more. And now that I have given the one chapter to the theme that so filled my heart, and so often made it ache and ache again, I pass on, unhindered, to the event that had impended over me longer yet, the event that had begun to be prepared for, before I knew that the world held Estella, and in the days when her baby intelligence was receiving its first distortions from Miss Havisham's wasting hands. In the Eastern story, the heavy slab that was to fall on the bed of state in the flush of conquest was slowly wrought out of the quarry, the tunnel for the rope to hold it in its place was slowly carried through the leagues of rock, the slab was slowly raised and fitted in the roof, the rope was rove to it, and slowly taken through the miles of hollow to the great iron ring. All being made ready with much labor, and the hour come, the Sultan was aroused in the dead of the night, and the sharpened axe that was to sever the rope from the great iron ring was put into his hand, and he struck with it, and the rope parted and rushed away, and the ceiling fell. So, in my case, all the work, near and afar, that tended to the end, had been accomplished. And in an instant the blow was struck, and the roof of my stronghold dropped upon me. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.